This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And in studio, one of the most fascinating people in Louisiana political history, the Honorable Henson Moore, former U.S. Congressman from Baton Rouge, represented this area for 12 years as the House member from the 6th District, and he is here to talk about what's going on in contemporary American politics and also about reflecting concerning some of his life as we know it, and he has had quite a life. 877-217-5757, 297-5633. Let's start with September 11th, 2001. It was 17 years ago we had the attack on our country. Where were you, Henson Moore?
I was on the Hill in a senator's office, and we had a TV set, and all of a sudden we were watching it live, and we were all dumbfounded and stunned. The meeting broke up, and I walked in front of the Capitol, which was a target of one of the planes, I guess the one that went down in Pennsylvania. And then I got in the car and drove home, and as I was driving over the freeway, looked down and saw the Pentagon burning. A day you'll never forget.
And a day, it's Brian Williams last night. I heard him on MSNBC say that it was the last day of innocence for our generation. You were barely born when Pearl Harbor happened, but this was certainly comparable, if not even more profound, than Pearl Harbor.
We were so protected by oceans for so long. And then suddenly with Pearl Harbor, then now in our generation with the terrorist attacks in New York and then in Washington, D.C., we realized that it's a much smaller world than we had first thought.
Shortly thereafter, you came back home. You had spent some time in Washington, as we know, not only as the
31 years.
Yeah, but also at the highest levels of our government. And before we get to the return to Baton Rouge, you served right there with the President of the United States, the 41st President, George Herbert Walker Bush. You were in all the meetings. I'm sure that was heady stuff.
It certainly was. I kept a diary. I was asked, an old friend of mine here in town said, you know, you're going to be the only one in your family probably to ever be in a position like that. You ought to keep a diary. And so for 1 year, I kept a diary every day, and Marlon Fitzwater saw me doing that on Air Force One. He was the president's press secretary. He said, I know what you're up to. You're going to write a book when all this is over with. That diary has remained closed and on the shelf in my library, as it's quite frankly too painful to pick up and read. So nobody will ever see it except my grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Well, have you ever thought about writing a book?
No, that's I just have a feeling that when you're on the inside of something like that, the president's counting on. Matter of fact, he asked me not to talk to the press while I was there in the White House, and I didn't, and I paid a price for that, quite frankly. But in any event, I just sort of feel like that those things you saw, and I saw some things where there were just two of us in the room or maybe three of us in the room counting the president, that some historians aren't aware of, but it's not my place. That was a place of confidence, and I feel very strongly that what I saw, I might talk to friends about when they ask about it, but it's not going to be something to put in the media.
Well, what do you make of what's going on now with high-ranking officials writing op-ed pieces to the New York Times, talking to Bob Woodward, the president, and I can't blame him. He's upset about this, and we may have all the officials at the highest levels taking lie detector tests.
Well, it's the one fault this president has is that he has not been in politics and he hasn't learned to develop that thick skin. He has a thin skin, as all people do, but politicians learn to resist getting back at that. I never heard George Bush Sr. ever complain about the media, but he did it in private. When we would meet with him first thing in the morning, he's got all these newspapers, and he was sitting there pounding the table. Why did they say this? Who said that? How did this leak get out? Every president deals with that. Every White House deals with that. whether this one is worse than others, I don't know how you measure those things. But certainly anything that's bad in this White House seems to get more attention than, say, bad that was in the Obama White House. That's just the way of the world. But it happens in every White House.
Well, George Bush the first, I think he could probably make a case that he was treated unfairly by the media. I'm not sure this president has. I think he's getting, basically, he's brought it on and they're giving back. But George Bush the first, now regarded as a exceptional president, but not at the time. He was challenged from within his own party by Pat Buchanan, which hurt him dearly in that 92 election.
Made him mad, too.
I'm sure it did. And the media often called him a wimp. In fact, I remember the son, who later became president, was visiting with a writer, and he circled a story, and wimp was in the story like 18 times. And he says, you know, my dad may be a lot of things, but he's not a wimp. And yet that was the perception by some.
It was a perception because he had the misfortune of following President Reagan, who people adored and people thought was, because of his movie roles and his persona he projected as president, as being a very strong leader. And unfortunately, Bush followed that. And Bush was a different kind of a person. He was very much a gentleman, very much a man of the world, people who he had contacts all over the world that he knew, and I saw that firsthand. And give you a funny example, that I was in the White House that when the president was calling leaders of the world to get ready to put together the coalition to throw Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And matter of fact, as I remember, there were some 22 or 23 countries that sent troops, including Syria.
Right.
An unimaginable coalition. And he was putting that coalition together. And the first call he made was to Margaret Thatcher. And I'll never forget, I was sitting there, after there's a picture in my library, I'm sitting there when he's making that call, and he's sitting there writing left-handed, taking notes, and yes, Margaret, like that. And he hung up, and he said, do you know what she said? And he died laughing. And everybody said, no, Mr. President, what'd she say? She said, now, George, don't you wimp out on me. If we're going to kick him out, let's do it, but don't you wimp out. And so he was catching that even from heads of state. But I think it's simply because he followed a man that just had a different public image.
Well, and he served in the military. He was a war hero.
Absolutely.
George McGovern was a war hero, too, and was portrayed by many as a wimp. And it's sometimes it's very difficult to get rid of those perceptions that people have that their opponents often place on them. This president, as we know, did not serve in the military, took 6 draft deferments, but he is regarded as the consummate alpha male.
Well, it's all persona, which I guess can be carefully cultivated or can just happen. This president, you remember, we had, 16 people in the Republican primary. Probably 13 or 14 of those people, most Americans would have thought would have been a great president. And this fellow had the intelligence or the ability or the sixth sense, whatever you want to call it, to win when none of the rest of them could. And he won a race that nobody thought he could win. I think he identifies, quite frankly, like Reagan did. He identifies with, they used to call them the Reagan Democrats. I spent some time in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan in my years of representing the paper industry, and saw the paper mill towns and the paper mill workers and even in the bar with them every now and then. And that's who he appealed to, and that's who he won the election by. And so you got to figure that there's a similarity there between those two.
How do you think the midterm elections will go based on the fact that this president has a hardcore 40%? It's not soft. It's hard. But then the rest of the country apparently doesn't like him very much.
Who knows? We see the polls day to day. Historically, the party in power loses seats, and so I think everybody probably ought to expect that to happen. And if you look at what's going on around the country, you have a number of Republicans standing down and not running again and making it an open race, which gives a Democrat, obviously, an even better shot. And so I think the cases are, you know, it's entirely possible that the Republicans will lose the House of Representatives, may hang on to the Senate, may even gain a seat or two, but it's going to make it really rough for President Trump to finish whatever his program is, just like it was rough for President Obama. He had a party in power for 2 years, passed Obamacare, then he spent 6 years being on the outside trying to do it by presidential fiat in regulatory matters. So it's going to be tough, but I think that the odds are that the Republicans will lose seats.
What about Brett Kavanaugh? It appears that he has the votes to be the next Supreme Court justice. Your former boss nominated and had confirmations for Clarence Thomas, which right. worked out about the way he wanted, and David Souter, who turned out to be a totally different man.
Yeah. That's the history of the Supreme Court, is that presidents try to appoint people that are going to help them perhaps in their administration. Roosevelt had a tremendous fight, remember, trying to pack right. the Supreme Court, and it doesn't work. You appoint these folks, and then they do what they think's right.
877-217-5757. We'll go to the phone lines with Henson Moore when we return with Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. Your numbers, again, are 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Elsewhere, 877-217-5757, and we will go to the phone lines in just a moment with Henson Moore, represented Louisiana and the 6th District on Capitol Hill for a dozen years and became Deputy Chief of Staff to President George H.W. Bush. He was the Deputy Energy Secretary and also head of the National Forestry Association. So 31 years in Washington, but he came back home. And before we talk about his return to his hometown, 1986, a race for the ages. You and John Berlinger Bro duked it out, and some thought you would win based on the fact that there was a popular Republican president in office, but there were other things like Iran-Contra, and also Louisiana at that time was largely a Democratic state. You were one of the first GOP congressmen in history. Now, if it were an even match between a Republican and a Democrat, the Republican would win in Louisiana, let's face it. But then it was a different story. It was a big climb for you to try to be elected as a Republican U.S. Senator at that time. What happened in the last 32 years?
Well, it's just we saw it. I didn't see it coming when I ran for Congress. My gosh, everybody said, why in the world do you want to be a Republican in a Democratic state? I didn't see it coming, but people like Larry Sabato, a well-known political observer at the University of Virginia, saw it coming. I think basically the political philosophy of people in the South was really more moderate to conservative than it was moderate to liberal. And it was only when the Democratic Party stop being, in their eyes, moderate to conservative, that the states began to change all across the South. And so I don't think the people in the South changed. I think that the national parties probably changed somewhat.
John in Houston, please be brief, John. We start with you and former Congressman Henson Moore. You're on Talk Louisiana, John. Good morning. Matt, do we have... Okay, let's try. Let's keep John there, see if we can get him back, and go to Randy and Zachary. Hi, Randy. You're on with Congressman Moore.
Yes, Congressman Moore. I've noticed there's been a big, gigantic change in the atmosphere in the country. There's no order or stability, and people are just shouting and hollering, and other people are not listening. Thanks.
All right. The tenor has changed for the bad.
I think the center's disappeared. I think we now have the extremes in both parties. What we're seeing in the lack of civility in politics today is something that certainly didn't exist in my days in Washington, and something I do not countenance or do not support. Where it's leading, it seems to me, are divisions so deep among the American people. How do you ever get them together again? In a divided country, is not a good idea. We saw it recently in these Kavanaugh hearings where people were actually coming in and disrupting the hearings, and that's a lack of civility. You never heard of that in my day. And I watched Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California. She was watching those protesters, and there was a scowl on her face. I don't think she liked it either. The point being is, if this continues to where whoever's in power, you actually want to run them out of power or undermine their ability to govern, that leads to anarchy. Because whatever one party does, if it works, the other party is going to pick it up. And so the last thing you want is when we have a Democratic president, the same kind of shenanigans going on of where you really want to run them out of office. You don't want them to succeed. You don't want them to govern.
John in Houston, we'll give it another shot. Are you there, John?
Good morning. Yes, I'm here.
Yes, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your question?
What I wanted to ask was, what you just mentioned is very important for everybody to listen, because trust me, I've been a Democrat for a long, long time, but I voted for Trump not because I liked Trump, but I voted for Trump because Trump represented the club that I wanted to smash the Congress to send a message.
All right, that's the drain the swamp crew. And certainly that's probably how Donald Trump won the election.
Well, I think, you know, he ran against the established Republicans, whoever they are, wherever they are, and he won. And I think that certainly he's governed that way. The interesting thing about him is he's a politician who's doing what he said he would do, God forbid. And that most politicians give speeches to get elected, and then I'm not sure they really spend that much time thinking about him after they win. Evidently, because he's not a politician, he's taking it seriously. I, too, do not like him personally. I don't think many people do. He's a tough New York businessman. And that's just not the way we're raised here in the South or whatever. On the other hand, he's governing, as I think we hope, as I would like to see the country governed. He's doing what he said he would do. He cut taxes. I think the economy rolling along now is greatly because of that. I was there the last time we had a tax bill that was under Reagan, and we had similar responses. His Supreme Court appointments, I think, are what we'd like to see. We'd like to talk about, if somebody would like to, what's going on in trade. It has a lot of people scared, but I have a little different view of what's going on in trade as a result of what he's doing. He's acting like a businessman instead of a politician in trade, saying, this deal's not good, I want it changed. And here we've had Mexico come to the table, Canada's at the table, now Europe's coming to the table, and we're going to get a better deal as a result of that. China's going to be the hard nut to crack, but I don't think anybody thinks we're having fair trade with China, and something does need to be done.
David in Atlanta. Hello, David. You're on the air with Congressman Henson Moore.
Good morning, gentlemen. Two facts regarding 9/11. James Intelligence Review, the holy grail of intelligence, reported prior to 9/11, when George W. Bush was president, they gave the United States, Russian intelligence gave United States intelligence the exact location of bin Laden, who was under indictment for mass murder in the African embassy bombings. And this is a quote, according to James Intelligence Review, for political reasons, George W. Bush chose to take no action. And furthermore, Janet Reno and President Clinton begged and urged the House of Representatives, the Republican House of Representatives, more than a year after the Oklahoma City bombing, to pass anti-terrorism legislation, and the Republican House of Representatives gutted the legislation.
All right, David, you're on a roll, but this is a terrible day in our history, 17 years ago, and there are those who are still pointing fingers.
Anytime something goes bad, the first thing you do is you point fingers at the government in power as to why they let that happen, why didn't they do something. Those may be good questions. I'm not familiar with the information he's talking about. I can't imagine any American president seeing this was going to happen and not doing something to prevent it if he thought he could.
Gustavo in Goodwood. Gustavo, you're on with Congressman Moore.
Congressman Moore, good morning. The last few statements that you made, it almost seemed like you were giving props to Mr. Trump for some of the accomplishments that he has done, like the tax cuts that he has done and the agreements that he has reached with Mexico and Canada, China coming to the table. So I want to thank you, because you're one of the few people in this radio station that actually commends President Trump. So.
All right.
Well, thank you. I think that this president has trouble with the press, and I think he seems to enjoy it, and he seems to have his own way of dealing with it. In my day, you looked at the press as being the way to get whatever you had to say out to the voters and the people, but evidently with social media, that's changed a great deal. That's a whole nother book to be written mm-hmm. about politics.
Do you think you could work for him? For President Trump, do you think you could work for this president?
I don't know the answer to that question. That I think the current chief of staff is thinking about leaving, and the word that's filtered out of the White House is because the president's not listening to him. That's a good reason not to work in the White House. You either believe in the individual and you do what they ask him to do, or you go out and you don't stay there.
We'll return and spend a few more minutes with Henson Moore. 877-217-5757 is your number. talk@talklouisiana.org is our email. And then we'll hear from the incomparable Marianne Sternberg. She's back in a big way with River Road Rambler Returns. Now the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Henson Moore, the former congressman, former deputy chief of staff to President George H.W. Bush, number 41. And then we go to Marianne Sternberg. But let's get to a few folks who have been waiting to talk to the congressman, Beverly on Highland. Beverly, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a comment about 9/11. I was in New York. I was living there. Friends of mine died there. I heard on September the 10th a talk given by Hillary Clinton at the Rytown Hilton, where she was very emphatic that the Bush administration was not listening to the security briefings.
All right. Well, once again, I think we can point fingers all day long, and there's not much we can do about what happened on this date 17 years ago. And we could take the rest of the show talking about who's to blame, but I'd rather not do that. And we have limited time with the congressman. Let's take one more call. Dan downtown. Thank you for calling, Beverly. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, Mr. Moore, you say that Trump is keeping his campaign promises. So should we first not build that wall till Trump somehow gets Mexico to pay for it? Second, have Trump reveal his income taxes? And third, not raise the deficit because of his tax cuts for the rich?
All right.
Well, as far as the wall is concerned, we'll see how that plays out. You know, he made a bold claim to get Mexico to pay for it. I don't think we know how that's going to happen. But he's still beating up on the Congress to come up with the money to pay for it. So we'll see what happens with that. Certainly, if the Congress changes hands, I think that'll be something that won't happen. As far as the tax bill, everybody is disregarding, because the way you view deficits is you don't take into account what's called a flowback, meaning you cut taxes and result the economy grows and you have more taxes flow in because of that. And that's what's happening with this bill. I think you're seeing the economy grow tremendously, and that is going to increase income tax receipts. But no tax cut is going to be scored as anything other than a deficit in the year you pass it, because they just don't use that in terms of their calculations. The Republicans have complained about it for years, even some Democrats, but that's the way it's done.
Between 2001 and 2006, you led LSU fundraising effort that was a $750 million goal. You ended up raising almost $900 million. And now the university is embarking on another one of these campaigns. But right now, there's a lot of talk about admission standards. What do you think of that?
You know, I thought you were going to ask me that. You know, I don't know. I'm tend to be concerned that we don't go back to the days we had before we had admission standards. When anybody could get in, and as a result, we spent an awful lot of money on remedial education in those days. About half the student body was taking courses to be able to take courses in math. And we don't want to get back to that. That was a waste of money. And that's what you have. We now have community college systems for help those students get into the university world. So I'm worried about that. And I'm worried also that this may be a way, a cloud by which you start having this admission system, which we don't know how it works, and we don't know exactly how people get in. When you start saying, well, we'll have letters of support or recommendation letters, we all know in the hiring world you pay no attention to those. So why would you pay attention to them? Because you can get somebody to write a nice letter about you, and that doesn't necessarily mean very much. And then you say, well, let's write an essay. Well, you could be getting help on the side to write that essay. So when you start having those kind of standards, I'm worried that's going to get us back into the mess we were in that lifted, and we got out of that mess as a result of the standards we have that got us up into a top-ranked university by U.S. News & World Report. And then I hear Harvard is being quoted as the place we want to be like. Harvard's in trouble right now in court over their holistic standards that kept Asians out. And so, you know, you start getting into, if you start picking who's going to get to come for social reasons, you're going to wind up eliminating people who have the right to be there by the standards.
Well, thank you, Henson Moore, one of the fine gentlemen from Louisiana, and we should have more like you replicating your tenure in public service. But
well,
thanks for your service, and also a military veteran. So thank you very much.
Okay,
appreciate
Jim.
It. And in studio, as we part company with Henson Moore, we're joined telephonically by the fabulous Marianne Sternberg, and she is back with her passion, one of them, River Road. Her book is River Road Rambler Returns, More Curiosities Along Louisiana's Historic Byway. Ernest Gaines writes, traveling the River Road with Marianne is an incredible opportunity to learn the answers to the multiple questions that inevitably arise when you drive it alone. Good morning, Marianne Sternberg.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And I think most people have a perception of the River Road. Maybe they've driven it a time or two, but they view these antebellum homes and plantation homes as the biggest draw. But you say the road is far more than that.
Yeah, I've been roaming the River Road now for 20 years, and I got started when I accidentally discovered that the River Road really is much more than that. You know, don't get me wrong, these houses that are open to the public are terrific, and each one offers a different experience for visitors, but there's so much more because the history goes back to prehistoric times, and anybody who enjoys exploring byways is going to find all kinds of things. And you probably remember my first book, Along the River Road, presented a kind of overview to this 100-mile corridor, which goes along both sides of the river between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And I wrote that as a background and a guide because I wanted to encourage people to go see the area. You know, it's so close by. You can pop out for an hour or you can go spend a couple of nights. Anyway, it didn't take me long to realize the River Road has so much more out there. And it is two worlds. There's the outside of the levee, which we know, which is where the plantation homes are, but there are also the sugar story with sugarcane fields and sugar mills and churches and cemeteries are all historic, and there are other non-secular places. There are old Creole cottages, plantations, general stores, little museums, the petrochemical industry, and then inside the levee, between the levees is a completely different world, which, of course, we miss because we don't, most of us have access to it. You know, the maritime industries and warehousing and barge moorings and the constant activity of the ocean-going ships and tugboats pushing barges, and I wanted to get out on that, too. So in both the original River Road Rambler, and in the new book, River Road Rambler Returns, I made a point of trying to ride something out on the river so I could explore that part of it as well.
Marianne's a native of New Orleans, as we know, a longtime resident of Baton Rouge, and her book is River Road Rambler Returns, and there are many stories along this 100-mile corridor. How many times have you been up and down it?
I wish I would have counted. I mean, you know, I dare say at least 100, but I'm talking seriously over 20 years. So there's no telling. And I've gone, you know, I've gone out to visit one specific place, or I've ridden one side in totality, and then crossed over and ridden the other side. I've spent the night out in a few of the accommodations, the plantations, and some bed and breakfast, and they're all great. They're great fun. So the answer is, I don't know, but an awful lot.
The book from LSU Press is out and about. River Road Rambler Returns, from Mary Ann Sternberg, 877-217-5757, if you'd like to join our conversation. Doug on Highland.
Good morning. I want to commend Ms. Sternberg for her books on River Road and the one on Bayou Man Shack. They're really great assets for people here locally about some real treasures we don't really, a lot of folks may not know we have. And unfortunately, I think one of the folks that don't know it is the East Baton Rouge Parish government, because there's no planning to do any type of protection on River Road that I know about. It's a beautiful landscape, and left to their devices, I think they're just going to turn it into wall-to-wall subdivisions. So hopefully the public will get more interested in that, because it is a real national treasure.
Thank you, Doug. Marianne?
Well, thank you, Doug. I don't know about lack of planning or whatever, but there are all kinds of things out there. In fact, in East Baton Rouge Parish, where L'Auberge Casino was built, they did a dig for Chatsworth Plantation, and that's one of the stories in my in the new book, because when you ride by now, you can't see anything left of Chatsworth, but it's a terrific story. And the artifacts are at the Rural Life Museum. So at least those are shared.
You tell the story behind the Sunshine Bridge, and what a story it is.
Well, you know, which seems like a funny subject, except that the Sunshine Bridge was the first bridge built across the river between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And it being Louisiana, of course, it had some political aspects to it. And as many of your listeners might remember, it was called the Bridge to Nowhere because it went from cane fields to cane fields for a long time. You know, that was a fun story. I did a story actually also on the Bonnie Carey spillway, the Bonnie Carey control structure. I'd never seen the opening of the control structure when they open it in flood season. So in January 2016, I went down, and it was really dramatic, and the Corps had set it up for visitors to watch, and they've even set up an exhibit in the little building they have with a video and, wall exhibit.
All right, hold tight. We're going to spend some more time with Mary Ann Sternberg, River Road Rambler Returns, and we're back. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and Mary Ann Sternberg is with us, and we lost her momentarily, but I think we'll have her back. Her book is River Road Rambler Returns, More Curiosities Along Louisiana's Historic Byway. Smiley Anders writes that Mary Ann Sternberg has gone rambling again down that 100-mile stretch of River Road she's claimed as her own following Walker Percy's admonition to know and presumably write about your own neighborhood. The old homes are here, but not the ones the tourists flock to. Those who love this part of Louisiana are delighted to see the return of this talented rambler. Do we have Mary Ann back? Okay. And Mary Ann, good to have you back to talk about your rambling down River Road. And you were talking about the Bonnie Carey Spillway when we went to the break.
Yeah, the opening, because the opening is really dramatic when they open it. And then, as I said, they have a little headquarters building there, and you can go in anytime they're open, and see a video, an exhibit of what it does when it's not fortunately happening. And, of course, it only happens in flooding times. But, you know, I wrote about so many different things. I did a couple of plantation stories for people who love plantations. I wrote about Ashland Belle Hélène, which was one of the iconic old plantation houses, and it was falling apart until Shell Chemical rescued it. So that was a good story. And I wrote about Columbia Plantation House, which was recently moved and restored. It was across the river in St. John Parish. And for Civil War buffs, I wrote about the only Civil War fort that's along the river between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, which is Fort Butler. But there's nothing really left of it. And when I last went, there wasn't even a sign that denoted it. And, you know, it was an actual Civil War battle. So I wrote about that.
Well, you had the last sugar mill.
The last sugar mill.
Yeah. That's quite a story, isn't it?
It is, because there used to be sugar mills behind all the plantations, and then they were consolidated, and now there is only one working sugar mill on the River Road, only 11 left in the state. This is Cora, Texas, and they were kind enough to let me come through during grinding season, which was a real wow, fascinating. Very digitized, but, you know, very... very noisy, lots of machines, lots of, bag-ass dust all over everything. And you watch the sugar cane going in, and then you walk through and you see what happens when it comes out as natural sugar. I mean, it's fascinating.
Leo asks, Leo in Highland Estates asks about Manresa. That's a big part of the life of some folks right here in Baton Rouge.
Right. Well, I did actually write. I have a story about Manresa in this book because, of course, I'd heard lots of men talking about making retreat there, and I'd only been able to admire it from behind the fence. But for the sake of writing a story, I wangled an invitation, and the director let me tour on one of the few days they weren't having a retreat. And I was fascinated to learn, I don't know that everybody who goes there realizes that the site had been four consecutive schools or colleges for young men before the Jesuit order transformed it into a retreat center in the 1930s. So there's some building standing there from all of these, and the grounds are really magnificent, and some of the old oaks date from the plantation that was there in the early 19th century before it was... before the grounds were made into the first one of the colleges.
Yeah, what about St. Mary's Jefferson College?
That was one of them. And that was one of them in the series.
You noted in your book as well.
Yeah.
You have these remarkable chapters, and the artwork, by the way, is quite impressive from LSU Press, but one of them is Buried Treasure. What is this about?
Well, that was the Chatsworth story. The archaeological dig,
yes,
out by L'Auberge Casino.
So, most people would not expect buried treasure to be at a casino, but
well, it's in there. It's in the landscape that is in front of the parking. It's across the road.
All right, and the Forgotten Fort.
Well, that's the Fort Butler story.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did a story about the Plaquemine Lock and the Lock House. The Lock House is now a museum, but the Plaquemine Lock was a really important part of river transport for a long time until it was replaced by the Port Allen Lock. So it's an old historic building and area, and it was nearly destroyed when the Highway Department wanted to widen Highway 1, and they wanted to knock it down and fill in the lock. And basically, through the efforts of one man, Gary Hebert and Plaquemine, who stood up to everybody and made enemies and saved the thing, and of course now the town of Plaquemine has realized that it's a great asset. It's a great historic asset for the town.
All right, Marianne Sternberg is back in a big way with River Road Rambler Returns, more curiosities along Louisiana's historic byway. And Holly asks, how long does it take to make this drive if you're doing it by the speed limit. So it takes a little longer than it does going to New Orleans by I-10, doesn't it?
Oh, indeed. First of all, it's only two lanes, and it's very curvy. And if you get behind big trucks, it slows it down. But, you know, you don't go on the river road to be in a hurry. If you were just meandering and you wanted to stop, you could go down either side and take most of the day.
And you've done it 100 times.
Well, I probably have. I mean, you know, in the course of the 20 years. May I mention my book signing?
Certainly.
Okay. Well, I am having a book signing on September the 22nd at Cottonwood Books, which is the last independent bookstore in Baton Rouge. And I know it's a football game that evening, but I figure on the way to tailgating, you could stop and buy a book from 10:30 to noon at Cottonwood on Perkins Road.
Cottonwood at Perkins Road, and what's the time to do it?
10:30 to noon on September 22nd.
All right. That'll be the Louisiana Tech game after LSU plays at Auburn this week. And Paul in Opelousas is on the line. Paul, good morning. You're on the air with Mary Ann.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mary Ann. Two things. One, I want to apologize. I'm born and raised in Louisiana, and I've never been to River Road purposely. I got lost a while back and found a bunch of stuff on River Road. Second, there's a lot of museums being established right now for civil rights and documentation. I know there's a wonderful museum, Sasa Gonzalez, that was, you know, documenting slavery and dedicated to the slaves and did a lot of research. Do you see other plantations going this way, documenting the life that happened on some of the plantations and doing the research? Thank you.
I think you're referring to the Whitney Plantation, which is over in St. John Parish, and about Edgard, which has been transformed into a museum of slavery. And I've got a story about that in this book, but it's not a story generally about the place. It's about the little church that was brought over. The church had been built in St. James Parish in 1868. It was built by freed slaves, and they used it for a long time, the descendants, and then it was empty and it was falling apart, and John Cummings, who owns Whitney, bought it and moved it over to his plantation, and he has peopled it with extraordinary sculptures of slave children that are absolutely amazing. Anyway, I wrote a story about that, and there is the River Road African American Museum in Donaldsonville, which I'd written about in the previous Rambler book. But I have a story in this one about a building. That museum talks about the contributions of African Americans from the time of slavery until contemporary times. And it's a wonderful little museum, and they got a building from across the river that is supposed to be a Rosenwald school building, and it's still in the throes of being restored. But the Rosenwald program was an educational outreach building school building program that was all through the South from 1910s to the really 1930s, and then the buildings were used until the 60s. So those two might touch on what Paul was interested in.
The book is River Road Rambler Returns from LSU Press, from Mary Ann Sternberg, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you, Mary Ann. Congratulations.
Thanks, Jim.
See you
so
soon.
Much. All righty. Bye-bye.
We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, and a note that Steve Wynum has sent me a note from John Kennedy's, that's our senator's high school yearbook. I mentioned that he might be running for president at some point. And sure enough, in his senior class, his ambition, to be successful and happy as president of the United States. That from John Neely Kennedy. We'll be back tomorrow. For Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.